Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Denmark says the drone incursions that temporarily shut down airports this week are part of a new hybrid war. It's not clear yet who is responsible, but many Danes are talking about one usual suspect.
You know, Russia has always been like that. We have never been able to trust Russia.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will hear more from Denmark today and how the United Nations is struggling to stay relevant.
The UN is in a considerable crisis, but it is by no means facing a death sentence.
Rugby fans have a big weekend to look forward to, and relocating a large, intricate, centuries-old tapestry that's also a priceless piece of history.
It's going to be very dicey as to how they transport it.
And music from a harmonica virtuoso from South Korea. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. We start today in Denmark, where major airports and military bases saw a series of mysterious drone incursions this week. They caused shutdowns and flight delays, stranding thousands of travelers. And it has led Danish authorities to conclude that what Europe's now dealing with is hybrid war.
Hybridkrig er ikke en krig I sådan traditionel forstand.
Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said this is not a war in the traditional sense. It is meant to create confusion and insecurity. The World's Josh Koh is in the city of Aarhus, which is located in western Denmark, where most of the drones have been spotted. He gave us a recap of the drone sightings across the country this week.
Well, let's start with Monday night. So there were three large drones spotted near the largest airport in the country in Copenhagen, the capital, and it was forced to close temporarily. And that airport is the biggest airport in the Nordic countries. You know, 20,000 passengers were impacted that night. And then after that, on Wednesday night, drones were reported at airports across Jutland, here where I live in the west of the country. Basically, every major airport at this point has been impacted by these drone sightings. Two of the biggest airports other than Copenhagen, that's Billund and Aalborg, also had to be closed out of an abundance of caution. And it's not just these civilian airports. I think it's important to note that an airbase, a key airbase for the Danish military, the one that houses the majority of its jet fighters, also had a drone sighting. This happened all on Wednesday night within the span of a few hours, and it doesn't seem to be over yet. Aalborg's airport, which I mentioned before, it had to be shut down again last night because of another drone sighting.
So widespread, potentially ongoing problems here. Do we know who might be responsible for all of this?
Well, in a speech that Mette Frederiksen, the prime minister, gave, she was saying that it's too early to tell, but she did note that Russia has been doing a lot of things just like this. She was referencing that earlier this month, we've seen Russian drone incursions into Polish, Romanian, and Lithuanian airspace. We also saw Russian jets push into the skies over Estonia. And I spoke earlier to Christian Santos Okholm. He's a Danish security analyst focused on hybrid warfare and based in Copenhagen. He was saying that, you know, Danish security services are already monitoring Russian hybrid attacks in the country.
What we know for sure is we've seen espionage attempts by Russian intelligence services. We've also seen Danish fringe actors have been hired by the Russian state to conduct disinformation campaigns in Denmark.
And I think it's important what he was saying there just about, you know, how Russia has hired people here in Denmark. We've seen reports elsewhere that Russia has been trying to recruit people to commit acts of sabotage or spread disinformation in other NATO countries. But with drones, it's so easy to just put a drone in the back of a van, as he told me, and drive up to the front of an airport. You know, authorities were saying that these drones were likely launched locally.
So what is the government in Denmark saying they're going to do about this drone incursion?
Well, today, Denmark is meeting with other European countries to discuss the drone threat and how to deter future incursions with a so-called drone wall.
And what is a drone wall? I've been hearing that today, but I can't picture it.
It's a great question. I know that they'll be speaking more about this at a meeting in Copenhagen next week, but I put it to Jukka Sovelainen. He's a director of vulnerabilities and resilience at the European Center of Excellence for Countering Hybrid Threats. It's a think tank based in Finland. He said this was initially an idea for a zone of defense along NATO's eastern border with Russia and Belarus.
And the drone wall's functionality mainly is to detect the drones. And a single detection is not enough. You need to be able to follow the route of drone as long as it takes in order to have a reaction to the drone, meaning taking it down.
So in other words, you might have automatic systems that can detect the drones and then shoot them down out of the sky. But what he was saying about what we just saw here in Denmark is that there's also probably going to be a need for drone defenses around key infrastructure like airports. The trouble being, though, that there's civilian aircraft flying in and out and you can't really use lethal weapons to shoot down these drones in those areas.
Figure out how to defend against this newish threat. Josh, are people there in Denmark nervous?
Well, speaking to people here in Jutland where these airports had to be shut down, there's some stoicism. You know, people feel like it's going to be okay, but there's also a little bit of edginess, and I think it's more to do with the visuals that they see around here. There's been a lot of talk about reopening bunkers, and if you walk along the coast here, you'll see a lot of bunkers in the forests, and these go back to World War II. I mean, Denmark is a very small country. Now they have a lot of allies through NATO, but there's a lot of concern about how exposed they are to the threat of Russia, which is across the Baltic from them. But I think what I heard that really struck me today was one woman I talked to, Uli Jensen. She's 59. I met her here in Aarhus in the city center. She said that it wasn't Russia that she was worried about.
I'm more worried about the U.S., what they think and what they do.
In regards to?
To everything, because we can't trust Trump at all. You know, Russia has always been like that. We have never been able to trust Russia. Even with different presidents, it's the same.
What does she mean there, Josh, about not being able to trust the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that needs some context. So what she's referencing there is what people are reading in the newspaper, like, every day. Here in Denmark, is Trump has been talking very publicly about taking Denmark's largest territory, Greenland. There's been a report that was recently out about an influence campaign in Greenland. Danish intelligence services have spoken about this concern that the U.S. might be sending people to Greenland to try and stoke this independence movement in the territory. So people feel like they're being squeezed from the east and from the west, from this longtime adversary, Russia, but also from a longtime ally now in the U.S., and they're not really sure what that means just yet.
The World's Josh Koh speaking to me from the city of Aarhus in Denmark about a series of recent drone incursions. This weekend, voters in Moldova head to the polls. The president there is calling this the most consequential vote in the nation's history. Maia Sandu, the incumbent, has accused Russia of waging an unprecedented campaign to sway the results. And although Moldova is a tiny country with a population of less than 2.5 million, the impact of Sunday's vote could extend well beyond its borders. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Natalia Serbu lives in Dublin, but she's flying home to Moldova this weekend to vote.
Oh gosh, it's so important because we would like to join in Europe and we have to understand, like, this is the most important way to be a part of Europe family.
Serbu, who's from Chișinău, the Moldovan capital, has been living in Ireland for the past 7 years. She could vote from there, she says, but she wants to be in Moldova with her family when she goes to the polling booth.
Family, it's very important for me, and I would like to be with them in this so important day for us.
Serbu is part of Moldova's huge diaspora. More than 1 million live abroad, around a third of the country's population. And the Moldovan government says pro-Russian forces have been actively targeting them with disinformation campaigns. Earlier this week, police arrested 74 people they say were planning to incite mass riots ahead of Sunday's vote.
Totodată, în cadrul urmăririi penale a fost identificată și documentată activitatea unui grup.
The investigation identified a group trained in Serbia to provoke unrest, the country's chief prosecutor, Victor Fortuna, told reporters. Each person was paid €400 to take part, he said. That night, President Maia Sandu accused Russia of pouring millions into Moldova to try and spread disinformation and fear.
Kremlinul crede că noi toți suntem de vânzare.
The Kremlin believes we're all for sale, that we're too small to resist. But Moldova is our home, and our house is not for sale, she said. Moscow has repeatedly denied meddling in the country's internal affairs. Moldova declared its independence almost 35 years ago, as the Soviet Union fell apart. But the country still has a significant Russian-speaking population, and allegations of interference from Moscow at election time is nothing new. This time around, experts say, a lot of fake rumours are focused on Maia Sandu and the ruling party's desire for EU membership.
Saying that going towards EU would mean that we would be a NATO-allied country and the NATO troops would come to Moldova, that the West is pushing Moldova towards the war.
Andrei Cururaru is co-founder of Watchdog, a think tank in Chișinău. Much of the disinformation appears on TikTok and Telegram, often pushed by influencers, he says. But there's another group that's spreading pro-Russian propaganda.
Hundreds of priests have been sent to so-called pilgrimages this year, mostly to Serbia, Israel, Turkey.
The priests are being instructed in what to say in their sermons about the European Union and the government, Cururaru says. They're telling the public not to vote for Maia Sandu's party, saying if they do, the Moldovan Orthodox Church could be forced to close, he says. Sandu is ahead in the polls, but her party's popularity has fallen. And it's not just Russian propaganda that's dragging it down.
We've seen high inflation in Moldova. We've seen low wages. Basically, Moldovan citizens do not feel the progress made by the ruling party.
Laurentu Pleșca, who's originally from Chișinău, is with the German Marshall Fund. The economy, social welfare, tackling corruption, these are key issues for voters, he says. But there's another even bigger concern.
The main fear of Moldovans is the war in Ukraine. Both pro-European parties and pro-Russian parties are bringing up this subject.
Pro-Russian parties claim Moldova will get dragged into the war in Ukraine if Sandu wins because of her party's close ties with EU and NATO leaders. Pro-EU parties say a pro-Russian government would see Russian forces use Moldovan infrastructure, like its airport, in the fighting. EU chiefs, for their part, are blunt about who they want to see come out on top on Sunday. Roberta Metsola, President of the European Parliament, was effusive when she invited Maia Sandu to address lawmakers in Brussels a few weeks ago.
Dear Maia, you have long been a valued friend to this Parliament, and it is truly an honour to welcome you back to Europe's House of Democracy.
And French President Emmanuel Macron addressed a cheering crowd in Romanian in Moldova last month.
Trăiască Moldova in Europa!
Long live Moldova in Europe. Long live an independent Moldova. Long live a united Europe, he shouted. But Europe's support may not be enough to keep Sandu and her pro-EU party in power. Around a quarter of voters say they haven't yet made up their minds how they will vote on Sunday. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We've got an update on a story we covered earlier this year. In a London court today, the terrorism charge against a rapper from the Irish hip-hop group Kneecap has been thrown out on a technicality. Liam Oak Ohana, who performs as Mo Chara, was charged in May after allegedly displaying a Hezbollah flag during a concert last November. The chief magistrate in the case ruled today that the charge of terrorism was unlawful and null because it came more than 6 months after the alleged flag-waving incident. Outside the courthouse, Ohana said the entire process was a political attempt to silence the band. They've become outspoken advocates for the Palestinians in Gaza. The Crown Prosecution Service is now weighing whether to appeal today's decision. This is The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Iran is facing an imminent deadline on its nuclear program. If the government in Tehran does not meet certain obligations by tomorrow, it could see European powers reimpose economic sanctions. A senior advisor to Iran's supreme leader and one of the country's top security officials is warning Western nations not to take that step. Ali Larijani says if sanctions are reimposed, Iran will stop cooperating with international nuclear inspectors. Reporter Sebastian Walker was recently in Iran. He is working on a new frontline documentary looking at the aftermath of 12 days of bombing in Iran by U.S. and Israel.
We obviously have a lot of questions about the extent of the damage to the facilities and just how much that has set Iran's nuclear program back, and trying to really kind of understand what the impact has been overall, how effective that, those actions were.
Were you able to visit any of the damaged nuclear sites?
We were not. It's always very controlled, very restricted reporting conditions in Iran. This is my fourth trip to the country. It's very difficult to get to go to the places that you want to go. We pushed really hard to try to access Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan, the three sites where U.S. strikes took place. But in the end, it was impossible. We were told that it's just not going to happen. And they are also not letting UN inspectors into those places, too, which was one of the main parts of the interview that we conducted with Ali Larijani, where he was basically saying that if these sanctions are reimposed this coming weekend, they will end their participation with the UN Weapons Inspections Agency.
So how much were you able to ascertain about the state of Iran's nuclear program? If you couldn't go to any of those sites, if weapons inspectors are not able to go to those sites, what takeaway were you able to bring back?
Well, we were able to travel around the country. We went to Isfahan. We went to the north of the country. We went down to the south, looking at some of the impact of the strikes that the Israeli forces carried out. We went to the scene of various locations where Iran's leading nuclear scientists were eliminated. But yes, no, we were not allowed close to any of the facilities. So that's really it's really hard to tell. I think that a lot of what we're going to be exploring in our documentary is also going to be visual investigative work. Satellite imagery analysis really is kind of the only way that you can get close to understanding what's happened at these places.
Right. And you asked Ali Larijani, you know, point blank about their nuclear plans. Let's play that.
Can you say definitively here now after the strikes that Iran has no intention of developing a nuclear weapon?
What is he saying there, Sebastian?
He's essentially saying that there is no plan to obtain a nuclear weapon. He's saying that that is the policy of the Iranian government, and I pressed him on it. And in the future, is that out of the question? It is not the policy of the Islamic Republic to pursue nuclear weapons, was his answer there.
It was just very straightforward, no.
Straightforward and, categoric. We were trying to get a kind of sense of how much this had set the nuclear program back. And our takeaway overall was that they really are trying to keep their cards close to their chest on how much damage was done. Mm. This is one of the leverage points that they still have. Mm-hmm. They're not letting inspectors into these places. They're not divulging how much damage was done. They want this to be a mystery, essentially. They want to preserve some sense of uncertainty about how much capability they still have. And we pressed him on, trying to get an assessment of the damage, and he was he demurred at each point.
Were you able to understand what impact the killing of these key Iranian nuclear scientists has had on the Iranian nuclear program?
It's a really good question. We've focused quite a lot on that. That was one of the parts of this story that we were able to explore quite a bit. It's going to be a real focus of the documentary. Like, how much does this set the program back? If you take out, the most experienced and knowledgeable scientists at the very top of the program, does that set back Iran for months, years? Like, what does it mean if you eliminate those people? And I put that to Larijani as well, just saying, how has this impacted the progress of the program? Are you worried about not being able to replace this kind of knowledge? He was very, he kind of brushed that aside, saying that once you've invented this technology, then that's something that stays. But it's definitely a huge setback. These were some of the most experienced scientists that Iran has, people who've been instrumental in the program, people who've been sanctioned by U.S. authorities in the past, and the fact that Israel was able to target these people so effectively, they eliminated several of them simultaneously in different parts of the country at the exact same time. It was a really remarkable feat in some ways that they were able to pull that off. That's obviously, it also creates an atmosphere of fear in the country around other people who are involved in the program. Like, this is something that it really kind of sends a message that I think is a difficult one to navigate.
Sebastian, you're also working with the Washington Post. The paper has a story out today saying that Iran is continuing construction at an underground military site called Pickaxe Mountain. I know you asked Larijani about this. What can you tell us about that project and his response?
Yeah, the Washington Post has been doing some fantastic work on this. And yeah, you're right. This new story is that they've detected activity at an underground site south of Natanz known as Pickaxe Mountain. While that doesn't show with any certainty that Iran is moving towards, a nuclear weapon capability, there's definitely questions about what this new activity signifies. So we asked Larijani directly about this, whether he could tell us anything about this new activity, asking him to comment on that particular site, and he declined. He said there was nothing he could say.
Reporter Sebastian Walker was recently in Iran working on a documentary for Frontline that will come out later this year. It was quite a week in New York, where the United Nations convened for its 80th General Assembly. Global events are making it more difficult than ever for the world body to find its feet. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. At United Nations headquarters in New York this morning, delegates from more than a dozen countries got up and walked out of the General Assembly when the Israeli Prime Minister walked up to the podium.
Please order in the hall.
Benjamin Netanyahu went on to scold nations that recognized a Palestinian state earlier this week. There was also much scolding on Tuesday from President Donald Trump. He used his speech to question the relevance of the United Nations. The 80th UN General Assembly wraps up on Monday, and the world's Shirin Jafari has been covering the story for us. Hi, Shirin.
Hi, Carolyn.
So, Shirin, I want to get to this bigger question of the UN's relevance in a moment. But first, tell me more about Benjamin Netanyahu's speech. I understand at one point he announced that the Israeli army had taken control of mobile phones in Gaza and that his speech was broadcast live on those phones.
Yeah, exactly. So as he approached the podium, like you said, the delegations from other countries started to walk out, and he basically started talking to more or less empty room. Still, he sounded defiant, and he said that the world is not going to, quote, shove a Palestinian state down the throat of Israel. He said that Israel is going to, quote, finish the job against Hamas. And again, as you said, his office said today that the IDF has taken control of the telephones of Gaza residents and Hamas members, and that his speech is being broadcast via telephones to people inside Gaza. And there were reports that Israel has positioned loudspeakers towards Gaza and is broadcasting the speech. But according to the Washington Post, they reached a couple of people inside Gaza today about this, and they told the Washington Post that they haven't heard anything from the loudspeakers, and they also didn't get any messages or anything on their phones. Mm. So that's the reporting that we have from today.
So potentially some conflicting reports there from the prime minister versus people on the ground.
Yeah.
All right, Shirin, moving on to your broader impressions. What were some of the key highlights for you over the past week?
President Trump, in his speech, told European leaders that they're, quote, destroying their countries by allowing in more immigrants. He told them, your countries are going to hell. So that was one moment that stood out for me. There was also the summit at the General Assembly hosted by Saudi Arabia and France, where several countries, including Canada, Australia, and the UK, recognized a Palestinian state. That was a significant moment this week as well. And then, of course, as I reported yesterday, the big moment for Syria a country that has not been present at the UN General Assembly for roughly six decades, making its first appearance. So these were some of the key moments for me.
Mm. Shirin, you and I have covered past UN General Assemblies together before, and I know that there is stuff that happens that does not make the headlines but is still revealing. Were there moments like that that you spotted this year?
Yeah, one of the most important aspects of the UN General Assembly is that it brings together in one place people who have the power and influence to make a huge difference in other people's lives. And there are moments that can be unplanned and surprising encounters and face-to-face interactions that can sort of humanize these individuals. I'll tell you about this moment that I experienced this week. It was when I was reporting and I stepped out into a hallway at the UN, and then I literally almost bumped into the Saudi foreign minister, Faisal Bin Farhan Al Saud, and his bodyguards were around him. And then he just casually went off and he was taking pictures of the past secretaries general that are hanging in the hallway. So that was a moment that kind of caught me off guard. And these moments help you sort of see these world leaders in a way that you don't typically.
Right. World leaders just like us taking tourist snapshots at the UN.
Yeah.
Of course, though, the UN faces a lot of challenges right now, a lot of questions about its efficacy, its ability to affect actual change. Was there evidence of those challenges this past week?
So, you know, the world faces many challenges today. There are several ongoing wars, climate change, health disparities, so much going on. And the UN Security Council has been ineffective in stopping what's happening in Gaza. The US keeps vetoing resolutions. On top of that, the US, you know, which is the biggest funder of the UN and home to its headquarters, has been attacking this institution. And not just verbally, but also cutting its funding. And this year, it just seemed that with the budget cuts and staff layoffs, the UN itself is in a difficult place. It also faces criticism from Israel, which accuses it of being biased and anti-Israel. But Daniel Forti with the International Crisis Group tells me that despite all of the challenges, there were, you know, hopeful moments at the UN this week, like the speech by the Syrian president or the Saudi-French summit. And in general, he says the UN does continue to play an important role on the global stage.
Public health, education, development assistance, refugee support. These are the areas that no one country and its leaders and governments can tackle on its own. So it's imperative we have a system of global cooperation that can provide a backstop to the civilians that need it most.
But right now, the current U.S. administration is removing funding from the U.N. It's taking a less multilateral approach to foreign policy. How does that affect what the U.N. does?
Forti points out that about 20% of UN's funding comes from the US. And once you remove that, that is a huge impact on the institution. But he says this is short-sighted.
These types of global public issues matter for the world's safety. And even if the immediate effects aren't seen in the US right now, the US can't isolate itself no matter how much this administration may want to.
But he also adds, given all the challenges that the UN faces, it is facing a crisis, but it's by no means facing a death sentence.
Mm. So, Shirin, I know that the UNGA is always full of street protests outside, trying to capitalize on all the attention. Were there any notable things being protested this year?
Yes, although not as much as we witnessed the previous years when we covered the UNGA. Maybe that's because of the approach that this administration has towards protests. But I did see people out near the UN protesting about Gaza. I spoke with one of the protesters. She only gave me her first name, Elizabeth. And she said she had come from New Orleans to protest about Gaza.
To show the rest of the world that we Americans do care about this issue. We're not going to be, you know, we're not silent any longer.
The sign that she was holding read, while the UN is meeting, Gaza is bleeding. And I saw other people holding similar signs, sort of conveying similar message. And today, as Netanyahu spoke, there were protests about his speech as well.
The World's Shirin Jafari wrapping up the week at the UN for us. Thank you so much.
Good to speak with you, Carolyn.
Rugby fans from all over the world will be in front of their televisions tomorrow. It is the final of the Women's Rugby World Cup. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on who's left standing for the championship game.
No matter the sport, after a major tournament like a World Cup, there's always going to be different opinions about which player was MVP. You could say it's the athlete with the most points, which would be New Zealand star, 18-year-old Braxton Sorensen-McGee.
She's still on her feet, is Sorensen-McGee, and she's lining up for the hat-trick. She gets the hat-trick.
Or the title could go to England's Sadia Kabea, who's racked up the most tackles.
Kabea goes round again. Ward has a shot, it's on the line, and it's an English try.
The debate is bound to go on in pubs and group chats for days. But one thing that's indisputable following this Rugby World Cup is that more people than ever before are watching.
And here is the maul, it'll rumble, they'll be roared on.
The opening game, England against the US, boasted a record attendance of more than 42,000 people in the stands. Millions watched on TV, and fans just kept coming to stadiums across England.
We've now sold over 440,000 tickets.
Competition director Yvonne Nolan shared the news at a press conference this week.
That's 100,000 more than our original objective, and three times the number that were sold for the last Women's Rugby World Cup. It's an extraordinary milestone that surpasses even our best expectations.
How that translates to the continued growth of the game is yet to be seen. But for fans today, it's been a fabulous 5 weeks of rugby.
I don't even know if I can find a word. It just like fills you up, and it's just so inspiring to watch how much the sport has grown.
Lisa McNeil is a firefighter who's been watching from Halifax in Nova Scotia. Canada is one of the squads playing in tomorrow's final. And one of McNeil's fire station co-workers is on the team.
Olivia adds her name to the long list of try scorers today.
Olivia DeMerchant has been a firefighter since 2023 and is competing in her fourth Rugby World Cup. She told The Guardian that she's using all of her vacation time to do it and switched a lot of shifts with coworkers. McNeil says they've been watching the games back at the firehouse.
Watching her compete on the world stage is truly magnificent.
She adds that rugby and firefighting actually demand some of the same skills.
Fitness, as well as teamwork, and then just the ability to be able to perform under pressure. And she's been playing rugby for a really long time. If you're at a fire or at a high-stress call, kind of the same thing, right? You're just, you have your team, you're working hard, you're giving it everything.
It's certainly impressive that DeMerchant is a firefighter and a world-class athlete, but it's not ideal for most elite players to have another job. Canada, despite being ranked second in the world, is a really under-resourced team. They crowdfunded almost $700,000 to make it to the World Cup. Tomorrow, they're up against one of the most well-financed teams in the sport, England.
And England will continue to stretch that win streak.
The Red Roses, as they're called, are ranked number one in the world and are the heavy favorites to win. They haven't lost a game all year. In fact, they haven't lost a game since it mattered the most at the last World Cup final in 2022. They've got a slew of fantastic players on their roster, including veteran Emily Skerritt, Megan Jones, a nominee for World Player of the Year, and Ellie Kildon.
Ellie Kildon, still going! Ellie Kildon!
Kildon is a force on the field, and off the field, her motto has struck a chord with fans. It's a Roald Dahl quote, "Lukewarm is no good." That'll certainly be the mindset tomorrow when England and Canada play for the title world champion in front of a sold-out crowd of 80,000 fans. The match starts at 11 a.m. Eastern. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you are one of those super organized people who plans their vacations well in advance, then you may already be looking for travel tips for next year or maybe even the year after. If that is you, then we have a tip for 2027 for you. That is when the Spanish town of Jerez de la Frontera is due to hold the next edition of its Copa de Jerez competition. It's a battle for the best sherry, which the town is famous for producing. Deutsche Welle's Ashish Sharma was at this year's event.
Against the backdrop of flamenco drifting out of bars and restaurants, the Copa de Jerez has been described as a culinary Olympic Games, as teams of chefs and wine experts, called sommeliers, gathered in the city to reveal their three-course meals, pairing wines for each dish to a panel of distinguished chefs. The event is organized by the Sherry Regulatory Council of Jerez.
Carmen Aumesquet, and I am the promotion director of the Consejo Regulador of Sherry Wines. Well, we really believe Sherry is a very versatile and very gastronomic wine. It's a very complex wine in terms of aromas and flavors. Recently, it was seen as an aperitif wine, which was quite unfair. So 22 years ago, we decided to begin this international competition, pairing sherry with different countries participating. The best way to enjoy sherry is with food, with different dishes.
Okay, well, I've managed to get onto the stage behind the scenes, so to speak. There's a bit of a break going on in the competition, so I'm going to have a chat with... Hello, Germany.
Hello.
How are you?
Jan Nachtigall, Restaurant Novanta. Germany has not a big sherry community, but it's always growing.
How long does it take to prepare a meal for this competition?
Ooh, it takes quite a while because you have to pair the different flavors of the sherry with your dish, and you have to keep trying. Maybe you think something is great, and then you try it the next time, and you think, oh, maybe I can change this, I can change this. So it can happen in one day. Or a dish can evolve in a year.
So I'm Zoe Donadio. I work at a Prestige Green Michelin restaurant.
Zoe, when you guys made your presentation, it really struck me because you made a really big point about sustainability. How important is that in terms of elite cuisine that we see these days?
I think it's more and more relevant, and I think everyone trying to have a better impact, and it's just figuring out how we go about having like high-level gastronomy, which can be done in a circular way, even just from where you store things, where you package things, Tupperware is reusable things, and cutting down on single use, but also kind of moderating our wastage in terms of the food side of things, but also in the wine side of things, you know, supporting people who work in a responsible manner, with no additives, no chemicals, and usually those tend to be the highest quality ones anyway, so...
Germany, UK, Mexico were joined in the competition by teams from Spain, the USA, Netherlands, Belgium and Denmark. The event brings in everyone from connoisseurs of fine Jerez wines to tourists who want to learn more about the historical link that sherry has with this region.
Well, I've just walked through the showroom where there is a wine festival taking place, and I've just stepped outside because I'm joined by Pablo Rincón, who is the quality control for wine for a company called...
Archeo Gastronomia.
Thank you. I knew I'd get that bit wrong. How important is wine to the economy of this Jerez region?
It is one of the pillar stones of the economy in Jerez. The winemaking here is something so embedded in the culture that the architecture of the city is conditioned by this profession. Most of the old buildings are old cellars, actually. The whole city is around the wine.
The two-day event has become a showcase opportunity for local bodegas. One of the oldest bodegas, Sanchez Romate, had the youngest staff members. I spoke to Blanca and Lucia.
60 or 70% of our winery is exported. So I think it's very important to have chefs that are very well known internationally to come here and get to know better our brands.
Yeah, Lucia, you and Blanca both seem very young, but are you finding that a lot of young people are also interested in it?
It's well known that young people is drinking less, so we're trying to catch this kind of market. We're trying to approach young people like us, because Blanca and I, we both love wines, and that's why our winery has people like us of our age in order to, you know, to catch with other people like us.
The surprising winner of the Copa de Jerez was Denmark, which impressed the panel with an adventurous combination of food and wines. Their unexpected victory, coupled with teams entering from as far away as Mexico and the USA, shows that the market for sherry is becoming more diverse. This is good news for the local industry, which depends on the product, but also means that the message from the organisers that sherry is a versatile drink that matches most meals is also being heard.
Ashish Sharma from our partners at DW. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Bayeux Tapestry is widely regarded as a masterpiece. It depicts the Norman conquest of England, including the Battle of Hastings in 1066. The piece itself is almost 1,000 years old. It stretches 230 feet long, and it is on the move. Last week, a team of 100 people very carefully moved the Bayeux Tapestry from France to a secret location. Next year, it will be on loan to the British Museum in London. The timing here is meant to coincide with the 1,000th anniversary of the birth of William the Conqueror. I heard more about all this earlier today from Cheryl White. She's a professor of early European history at Louisiana State University.
It's actually one of the rare pieces of art that we have that historians can almost use as a primary source record because it's so detailed in its accurate depiction of figures and scenes from that battle.
So this is being moved as part of a cultural exchange agreement between England and France. And I understand that the move has been in the works, being planned for several years. How do they plan to move it without damaging this fragile piece of art?
Well, that is actually, of course, sort of the central piece of contention about all of the discussion is how it can be moved. A lot of art conservators and specialists believe that it's unlikely that it can be moved without being damaged. Mm. It's 1,000 years old, so it is. Of course, it's going to be fragile, and we know that there's already existing tears and slippage that's in it from hanging vertically in the position it's been in. So it's going to be very dicey as to how they transport it. You know, the French president Macron has been very insistent that he trusts the authorities of the British Museum to handle this properly, that they have the ability to do that. But I think when you're talking about such a rare piece of art and something of such historical significance, it should raise our index of concern.
Mm, yeah, there has been debate on both sides, as you've mentioned. Some people say it shouldn't be moved. Some people say it should.
Right. So the whole thing is it has to be moved regardless. It's got to go somewhere. The central question might be how far can it be safely transported and the conditions under which that happens.
Why does it have to be moved? Why can't it just stay where it is?
Well, because they are doing the renovation there in the museum.
Do you have any insight on how they plan to move it from France to London? I mean, I imagine you don't just put it on a commercial flight or something.
Right. So the logistics of that are going to be really interesting because, you know, just taking it out of its where it is right now, that process of removing it took about a day just to remove it. And we're talking about 230 feet of it's an embroidery. Actually, it's not a tapestry in the way people think of tapestry. It's actually an embroidered cloth. And if you think about it, it took that much time to remove it, then what might it mean folding it, packing it. For instance, I know they've discussed transporting it by air.
Okay.
And the problem there is going to be that you might have fluctuations in air pressure or temperature that might take place in an airplane, especially if the plane is sitting, you know, parked somewhere. And I think also that then the concern, if you moved it across the channel, for instance, on a boat, then you're going to have motion as well that you cannot avoid. The whole thing is that the conservation ethics is really at the center of this because we are talking about a 1,000-year-old artwork. And can you really justify moving it just for diplomacy if, in fact, it could be more safely conserved somewhere close to where it is going to be permanently housed back in the museum there in France?
And it sounds like those ethics are debated. So some people think it is worth it and some don't.
Sort of at the, I can't get the center of all of this, has been this identity issue, because I think there are people in France who view it as an element of their identity, their heritage. And if you remove it and take it to Britain, of all places, that raises some people, I think, emotions really more than anything.
You mentioned that some of the value from this tapestry stems from the fact that it is a primary historical document.
Right.
Why else do you think this has remained so significant after all this time? I mean, there are other historical documents.
There's just really not anything like it. I mean, it is kind of unparalleled in, I think, art history in that, first of all, its sheer scale, the fact that it's 230 feet long, which would have taken years to create, but also the incredible detail, the rich detail and accuracy that many historians have noted about the scenes that are portrayed, the individuals portrayed, a pretty rigorous accounting of the events, not just of the battle, but the events leading up to it, you know, and the immediate aftermath. And so when I say it's used as a primary record, what I mean by that is that we can look to that and say, this is the exact sequence of events. You know, this is a true mirror of that day in 1066. And so yeah, I think that when you combine the historical significance with its artistic uniqueness, you really are talking about something that's very culturally important.
Cheryl White is a professor of early European history at Louisiana State University in Shreveport. To take us out today, we've got something from the vault. K-pop has so dominated South Korea's musical exports, you can be forgiven for not knowing about a ton of other Korean music, like the harmonica player Yeor Kim. Yeor Kim often duets with the French guitarist you're also hearing here, Antoine Boyer. They're covering Radiohead's exit music for a film. The harmonica is one of the oldest instruments in the world. It has its roots in Asia. A Chinese emperor back in 3000 BC invented the harmonica's ancestor, the Shung. Several thousands of years later, Yeor Kim from South Korea demonstrates her mastery of the chromatic harmonica. As she told the YouTube channel My Broken Harp, Kim thinks of her instrument as a beautiful tool guiding her on an artistic mission.
I want to communicate more often with people with this beautiful tool and explore the world of art beyond the limit of harmonica. Yes, it is my dream.
Here's another one of Yeor Kim's unlikely jazz covers, Don't Look Back in Anger by Oasis, again with Antoine Boyer on guitar. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. We are online at theworld.org, and you can find more of our original reporting on the World's new YouTube channel. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend, and we will see you again on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.